Chapter 20. Charisma. We need people who are driven, people who are aggressive, manipulative, people who can manipulate people to get them to do what they want them to do. It is 9 a.m. on a Friday. Bob, as distinguished-looking as Walter Cronkite, is telling a group of eager and very respectful applicants what the CIA looks for in a spy. The applicants are being considered for the CIA's career training program, the training program for the agency's elite. Most of the applicants will go into the CIA's Directorate of Operations, the side of the agency that engages in human spying. Some will obtain management positions in the agency's three other directorates. This has to be the strangest show in Washington, a place where the CIA uses a classroom setting to recruit people to become professional imposters. Competition to work at the agency is keen. Each year the CIA receives 150,000 to 200,000 resumes for only 2,000 full-time, part-time, and contract job openings. In all, the agency has 22,000 full-time employees and 4,000 part-time and contract employees. About 12,000 applicants complete all the requirements, including taking polygraph tests. Many drop out along the way when they learn they will have to reveal prior drug usage, when they find out more about the job, or when they simply get tired of waiting. The CIA does not tell applicants why they were rejected. One common reason for rejection is evidence of psychological problems revealed in psychological tests. Psychiatric treatment is also frowned on. Occasionally, in the course of trying desperately to pass the polygraph test, applicants reveal they have committed rapes or other crimes, information that is passed along to the FBI and, of course, disqualifies them for the job. So long as it is disclosed, homosexuality is no longer grounds for rejection. The CIA advertises in local media in all 50 states and has 12 recruitment centers throughout the country. Each year, CIA recruiters visit 450 college campuses. There, they play a videotape put together by an advertising agency. In the video, William Webster, wearing a button-down blue shirt and a blue and rust striped tie, looks earnestly into the camera. There's hardly any more diverse, complex, and truly worldwide organization than the CIA, he tells potential applicants. As our name indicates, our primary concern is intelligence, that is information, information that helps protect the security interests of the United States. The scope of this intelligence includes virtually every kind of information from all parts of the world, economic, political, military, scientific information about people, places, and events. Events that have happened and might happen. Wars, coups, terrorist acts, crop failures, elections, famine, drug trafficking, and natural disasters. All of these events and many more worldwide are the concern of the CIA. Based on the resumes, the CIA narrows the list of applicants to 5,000 and invites them to a 3-hour introduction to the career training program. Nearly all of the agency's spies in the Directorate of Operations come through this program, and more than half of those who join the program become spies. Only a few hundred a year are finally hired as operations officers. Specialists, such as biologists, physicists, engineers, and demolitions experts, along with clerks and secretaries, are hired directly. The introduction to the career training program takes place several times a year in Washington and other cities. In Washington, the session is held in the Ames Building at 1820 North Fort Myer Drive in Roslyn, Virginia. There is no sign on the building, and visitors must have an appointment to get in. CIA guards check identification. After receiving their visitors' badges, candidates go to a gray-carpeted room on the first floor at the rear of the building. Beige curtains cover the floor-length windows. School desks, in rows of 6 across, fill the room. The applicants, 39 in this case, sit expectantly at the desks, most appearing nervous as they clutch the yellow notebooks they have been given. Serious, well-groomed, and well-dressed, the applicants could all pass for prep school students. Most of them are in their early 20s, although a few are as old as 30. The men wear blue suits with white shirts. For the most part, the women also wear conservative suits. A third of the class is women, and there is one black man. This is a homogeneous group intent on projecting a wholesome image. Some 22% of the agency's new hires are minorities, according to Eugene J. Horan, the CIA's Director of Employment. Overall, 15% of the CIA's employees are minorities and 44% are women. Bob, wearing a gray suit, a white shirt, and paisley tie, introduces himself. He is from the Directorate of Administration, the side of the CIA that supports the rest of the agency by providing supplies, security, computers, and other necessities. The agency has four directorates, Bob says. The Directorate of Operations tries to recruit people. It's a little like a marketing job. The applicants are listening intently. Most of them have no idea what spying is all about, their conceptions shaped by movies and novels. The first thing a case officer has to do is answer a question, he says. Someone wants to know how much wheat the Soviets produced. It starts with a collection requirement. The example is not particularly apt. In the Soviet Union, CIA officers are usually after more sensitive classified material than harvesting techniques. It is left to state or agriculture department employees to obtain this sort of detail. Bob says most case officers or operations officers, spies who are staff members of an intelligence organization, work undercover, pretending to work for another agency of the U.S. government. They may meet potential sources of information at diplomatic receptions, for example. You start tasking with information collection. I need to know about your harvesting techniques. You use tradecraft, microfilm. You watch for surveillance, he says. It's received in Washington. It goes to the policymakers. It's a continuing cycle. It's not a 9-to-5 job, Bob says. Mostly they do agency work evenings and weekends, so it's a very strenuous career, but a very rewarding one. Bob says the Directorate of Science and Technology determines military capabilities through satellites, radar, and other sensors. The Directorate of Intelligence analyzes information collected by the other directorates. The analysts have to be extremely careful they do not cross into policymaking, he says. You have to have a thick skin to be an analyst. The paper comes back with red marks on it. Then there is the Directorate of Administration. That's my directorate, he says. It arranges cars, ships air freight for the DO, Directorate of Operations. We make sure they get their pencils. We arrange S&T, Science and Technology, contracts. Bob introduces Cecil, a black man wearing gold-rimmed glasses and a blue suit. He ticks off the requirements to join the career training program. Applicants must be U.S. citizens, 21 to 35 years old, and have a college grade point average of 3.0 or better. However, other circumstances like supporting yourself are taken into consideration, he says. Exceptional oral and written communication skills are needed, a track record in extracurricular activities, a stable work record. Military experience is good. We look for brains, smarts. Charisma is always good. We want impeccable character and integrity. You are asking people to be spies, to commit espionage. At the same time, we expect you to obey U.S. laws. The career training program takes a year, Cecil says, including internships of 8 to 10 weeks in 2 or 3 of the directorates. Here is a profile of a CT, he says. They come from all over the country. Average age is 27. 40% are female, 60% male. One half have advanced degrees, 2/3 have traveled overseas, 20% have good foreign language skills, 15% are from the military. As for salary, I'm sure most of you are interested in that. Or are you that patriotic that you don't care? Cecil asks rhetorically. A few applicants chuckle. You start as a GS-8 Step 5. It starts at $26,000, he says. Foreign languages, military experience, and or living overseas for an extended period qualify a new employee for a higher salary. Any questions? An intense young man asks about the organizational chart in a CIA brochure distributed when they arrived. He observes that no detail is shown for the Directorate of Operations. Cecil explains that the organization of the clandestine side of the agency is classified. Is training 9-to-5? Someone asks. You have a little night hiking, Cecil says with a laugh, referring to paramilitary training. It is now 9:50 a.m., and Cecil introduces the next speaker, Shirley, from the Directorate of Operations. Shirley is pregnant and wears a gray maternity dress and polka-dot blouse. She has short, graying hair. Whatever preconceptions the applicants have had about what spies look like, Shirley probably does not resemble any of them. I have been in the CIA 18 years, Shirley says. We like to think we recruit responsible people. We are the clandestine service. We recruit human sources. If you're going to be a spy, she says, you have to be certain how you feel on the moral issue. She does not spell this out, but the issue is of more than passing concern. To be a spy, a CIA officer must spend much of his or her life living a lie, pretending to be someone he or she is not, persuading others to turn against their own countries to commit espionage and become traitors. Not a job for everyone. Shirley says another part of working as a spy is carrying out covert action. Covert action is undertaken when diplomacy doesn't work, she says. It's designed to conceal the hand of the U.S. We put a high premium on social skills. You have to write well, to answer the standard journalistic questions of who, why, where, what, when, how. It makes a difference. You are not going to get recognition, she warns. You will not be in the newspapers. You have to have a passion for anonymity. Otherwise, there are other kinds of careers, military or what have you, for you. She does not say so, but the State Department is usually cited by CIA officers as the place where those who seek glory should go, and good riddance. Working as a spy can be a lot of fun, she says. She catches herself. Maybe I shouldn't use that word. She quotes an introduction written by former CIA Director William Colby to a book about how to apply to the CIA. Colby said that looking back over 25 years, he had good times. We want people who want to do something for their country. You have to have a strong desire to do something for the security of the U.S. Is your spouse required to be a DO, Directorate of Operations, officer as well? An applicant asks. Absolutely not, Shirley says. In the old days, she says, the CIA showed new employees a training film depicting a wife chastising herself for asking her CIA husband where he was going. This was silly, she says. CIA employees can give their spouses a general idea of what they are doing or where they are going without revealing sources and methods, the mantra of security-conscious CIA employees. On the other hand, you really ought to make sure your spouse does not have a jealous bone in his or her body. Is it extremely dangerous? Let's say you try to recruit the wrong person, an applicant asks. Shirley says there is a distinction between CIA officers, who generally operate under official government cover and therefore have diplomatic immunity, and the foreign agents they recruit to give them information. If you are going to pitch a Cuban, you might wait until the end of your tour in a country, she says. But a recruited agent does not have diplomatic immunity. Your agent may be hanged. You try not to pitch someone unless he is going to say yes. Do you recruit a friend? Yes, she says. What if I look American, someone asks. You can have a disguise. You can blend in. You don't have to swagger. What about paramilitary operations? We place a low priority on paramilitary, she says. We are not really recruiting paramilitary personnel. What if your mother or father is foreign? That's America, Shirley says. It's a big melting pot. We'll check them out. We give polygraphs. Now Mark from the Directorate of Science and Technology takes over. Is there anyone who is not familiar with James Bond? He asks. Mark says Q hands devices to the fictional spy so he can do his job, install bugs in a meeting room, for example, or put on disguises. I could change my appearance to a Michael Jackson look, says Mark, who is black. Mark lists the components of his directorate: the Office of SIGINT Operations, which deploys sensors and intercepts communications, the Office of Technical Service, which develops spy equipment, the Office of Special Projects, which determines locations of nuclear devices and facilities and does other special collection of intelligence, the National Photographic Interpretation Center, which analyzes satellite photos, and the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, which transcribes and translates foreign broadcasts. The SR-71 Blackbird, a follow-on to the U-2 reconnaissance plane that flies more than three times the speed of sound, is an example of the work of his directorate, Mark says. The plane is no longer in use, supplanted by spy satellites. Mark introduces Christina from the Directorate of Intelligence. Christina wears a forest green suit. Her graying hair is swept back. She refers to notes written on white index cards. I work in Soviet analysis, she says, peering over her reading glasses. We have the task of taking information, analyzing it, and addressing national security problems and bringing them to the policymakers. We take considerable pride in doing unbiased analysis, to say it the way we see it. We take all source information and write products, and we give briefings. There is a premium on getting information current and in an easily readable form. Every day, she says, we provide briefings to the President, Vice President, Cabinet members. There are 6 offices on areas of the world: Soviet East Europe, Europe, Near East, East Asia, Africa, Latin America. There are functional offices: economic, technical, geographic, nuclear weapons, leadership analysis on players. We are looking for people with strong analytical skills, research skills, the ability to think through problems, and people with good judgment. You are working with a team of smart people. There is high esprit. It is tough, hard work. Short deadlines cause stress, tensions. It is very fast-paced and competitive. It seems to me it would be impossible to work on the Soviet economy without going there, an applicant says. We have an embassy there. We read the papers and reports here. We have clandestine collection. A lot of Soviet economists now come here. We don't rule out travel, she says. It is 11:50 a.m. and Bob draws the meeting to a close. Each individual who is still interested will be interviewed separately. At the end of the interview, those applicants who are right for the agency will be handed an application. A look of shock passes over some of the faces. If we don't receive an application, we're not being considered for employment? An applicant asks. Right, Bob says. The application is 34 pages long, Bob says. But not to worry. Some of the pages contain instructions or certifications. The application asks for a listing of residences for the past 15 years, employment history back to age 17, brothers and sisters employers. Even birth dates and places of birth of mothers-in-law and fathers-in-law are required. Applicants will also be asked to take a psychological and aptitude test. They will be asked to provide a sample of how they write. Tell us who you are as a person. What do your best friends think about you? It will take 6 to 12 months before security checks are completed and jobs offered to those who have passed all the hurdles. A young man wants to know the extent of the background investigation. If I had dinner with friends in a summer in Yugoslavia, will you talk to them? He asks. Probably not, but we develop our own leads, Bob says. Bob raises the subject of drugs. There are no problems with a six-pack on a weekend in college. We look at drug use. If you inject something, that will cause a lot of strong concern. If it stopped a year earlier and can be explained by peer pressure, it might not be a problem. What also concerns us is having 3 to 4 credit cards and you don't have a job or have declared bankruptcy. Another applicant asks if every foreign national he has ever met must be listed. What if he cannot remember them all? If you can't, say you can't remember, Bob says. It is just before noon and the session is over. The applicants line up expectantly for their interviews near the front of the building. Understandably, the session did not explain what it really means to be a spy for the CIA. That would give away too many secrets. Nor did the session touch on the Office of the Director of Central Intelligence, which constitutes the CIA's 5th and most powerful component. Part 5. The Office of the Director of Central Intelligence. Chapter 21. Three Hats. Because of the way America had been caught off guard at Pearl Harbor, President Truman and Congress wanted to make sure that in the future U.S. intelligence would be coordinated. For that reason, Congress created a Director of Central Intelligence who wore three hats, one as the head of the CIA, one as the coordinator of the other intelligence agencies in the government, and one as the primary advisor to the President through the National Security Council on foreign intelligence matters. Since the Eisenhower administration, the panoply of U.S. intelligence agencies has been known as the intelligence community, suggesting a benign gathering of neighbors. Besides the CIA, the intelligence community consists of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the intelligence components of the Energy and Treasury Departments, the National Security Agency, the counterintelligence component of the FBI, the National Reconnaissance Office, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the intelligence elements of the Army, Air Force, Navy, and the Marine Corps, Other agencies that have intelligence-related functions, such as the Commerce Department, participate in some community councils but are not considered full-fledged members of the community. To help in coordinating the intelligence community, the Director of Central Intelligence has a separate intelligence community staff with its own director. The DCI also sits on a dizzying array of interagency groups and committees that coordinate specific activities of the intelligence agencies. The most important is the National Foreign Intelligence Board, NFIB, whose membership includes the senior official of each agency in the intelligence community. Through this group, the intelligence community approves national intelligence estimates that represent the views of the entire community. Through various committees, the board also decides what priorities to focus on and what classified information should be given to allies. The DCI is appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate. The President may also fire him. In carrying out his intelligence community role, the DCI has a Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. He serves both as Deputy Director of the CIA and as the DCI's deputy in coordinating the intelligence community. Like the DCI, he is appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate. In directing the CIA, the DCI has four deputy directors who head each of the four directorates. The DCI also has a number of staff offices that are not part of any directorate and report directly to him. These are the offices of General Counsel, Public Affairs, Congressional Affairs, Comptroller, the Special Assistant for Arms Control, who monitors compliance with arms control agreements, the National Intelligence Council, which prepares estimates, and the Director of the Intelligence Community Staff, which coordinates a number of intelligence community committees on such matters as security, information handling, and counterintelligence. In addition, a Deputy Director for Planning and Coordination reports directly to the DCI and has a staff of 16 people. Taken together, these staff offices represent the fifth segment of the CIA. As a result of legislation passed in 1990, the CIA's Inspector General is on the same level as the DCI on the agency's organization chart. Like the DCI, he is appointed by the President with the consent of the Senate. Overseeing the entire octopus-like community are not only the Congressional Oversight Committees, but the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, PFIAB, a citizen panel that investigates shortcomings and reports its findings to the President. Finally, the President's Intelligence Oversight Board, consisting of three members from outside the government appointed by the President, is supposed to report to the President any intelligence activities that appear to be improper or illegal. Most of the directors of Central Intelligence had no previous intelligence experience. Two of those, John A. McCone and Walter Bedell Smith, are remembered as being among the best DCIs. Smith, who served from 1950 to 1953, established the machinery for preparing national intelligence estimates to better coordinate the analytical work of the agency. McCone, who served from 1961 to 1965, sharpened the process for preparing estimates and established a fourth directorate for science and technology. On the other hand, William F. Rayburn, Jr., who served from 1965 to 1966, is remembered as one of the worst DCIs. Like McCone, Rayburn had no previous intelligence experience beyond what he'd picked up during his career in the Navy. Russell Jack Smith, a former deputy director for intelligence, recalled that when Lyndon Johnson intervened with U.S. forces in the Dominican Republic in 1965, Rayburn decided that he could best contribute by rushing every piece of paper received by the CIA to the President. But Richard Helms, then Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, calmed him down. Dick Helms's smooth intervention prevented the disaster that is risked when raw, unevaluated intelligence reports are placed in a President's hand, Smith said. I never worked for a nicer guy who was more out of his element, said Walter N. Elder, who was executive assistant to Rayburn. I thought President Johnson did him a disservice by naming him DCI. Other DCIs, such as Sidney W. Sowers, William J. Casey, and William H. Webster, had some intelligence experience in predecessors of the CIA or in other intelligence organizations. Only three, Alan W. Dulles, Richard Helms, and William Colby, had served in the CIA before being appointed director. Each director approached the job differently. Dulles, who served from 1953 to 1961, and Casey, who was DCI from 1981 to 1987, became highly involved in clandestine operations. Dulles always thought he was an excellent practitioner, Robert T. Crowley, a CIA officer at the time, said. I have no evidence to support that. Admiral Stansfield Turner, who served from 1977 to 1981, felt the CIA emphasized human spying too much, to the detriment of technical collection. Turner devoted a great deal of his time to the analytical side, sometimes substituting his own opinions for the estimates presented to him. They, the operations people, were the elite directorate, the untouchables, Herbert E. Hettu, Turner's director of public affairs, said. I think he, Turner, felt we got more bang for the buck from technical intelligence. You can't get intentions through it, though. He thought they, the operations officers, were important but overblown. They totally overreacted to that. By his quiet, princely manner, Helms, who was DCI from 1966 to 1973, gave an impression of harboring vast knowledge. He supported his troops while doing his best to deflect White House pressures to involve the agency in cover-ups, politically inspired estimates, and illegal activities. On the other hand, he approved the incarceration of Yuri Ionosenko, the KGB defector mistrusted by James Angleton. Aside from strongly supporting CIA operations and improving congressional relations, George Bush is remembered for doing very little during his one-year tenure as DCI, from 1976 to 1977. Turner is roundly hated for trying to diminish the importance of the clandestine side of the CIA and for cutting the staff of the Directorate of Operations in a crude manner. While the Directorate was overstaffed because of staff increases during the Vietnam War, the reductions could have been accomplished over 5 years through attrition. But Turner was impatient and decided to reduce the staff over 2 years. This meant 17 people were dismissed and 147 people were forced into early retirement. Many others were told to find jobs in other directorates or be fired. Those affected were told to find new jobs on October 31, 1977. The two-paragraph letter said, "It has been decided that your services are no longer needed." The action came to be known as the Halloween Massacre. In his book Secrecy and Democracy, Turner admitted that the wording of the notices was unfortunate, but defended speeding up the retirement process. He said complaints about the 147 forced into early retirement were beside the point. Almost all of them would have retired within a year or two anyway. Robert Rusty Williams, one of Turner's aides, spent his first few months at the agency looking into whether operations officers were having nooners or were drinking at work. Rusty Williams asked subordinates who I was sleeping with, a former station chief said. People said they presume my wife. After creating tremendous resentment within the operations directorate, Williams decided the staff operated ethically and soundly. I don't think people should be drinking at lunch, Turner said recently. They can have one if they want to, but he, Williams, found people who couldn't come back. They were drinking when they came into the building. They were genuine alcoholics and were producing only a small percentage of the time. But even Turner's aides conceded that his approach created unnecessary resentment. Any organization has its share of alcoholics, and by assigning an assistant to investigate the problem, rather than handling it through the chain of command, Turner seemed to be suggesting that he thought the CIA was full of drunks. Stam was book smart but street dumb, one of his former assistants said. He didn't understand how things would be perceived. In his 5 months as DCI in 1973, James R. Schlesinger never had time to get a handle on the agency, but he opened it up to public scrutiny by ordering the compilation of the Family Jewels, the list of the agency's past abuses. Colby ushered the agency into the modern era by emphasizing the need to operate lawfully and be accountable to Congress and the public. But Casey moved the agency backward by again involving it in illegal and improper activities. While he temporarily improved morale by acting as the agency's cheerleader, most CIA officers, including those in the Directorate of Operations, look back on his tenure overall as a blemish on the agency. Casey had a lot of problems and did a lot of things that didn't do a lot of people any good, a former CIA operations officer said. He did care about the agency. The amount of influence the DCIs have had with presidents has depended on their relationships with them. After the CIA foresaw the outbreak of the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War in 1967 and predicted it would last 7 to 10 days, President Johnson invited Helms to attend his Tuesday lunches with his inner circle of foreign policy advisers. Casey served not only as an intelligence advisor to President Reagan, but also, having worked in his presidential campaign, as a political advisor. Unlike Casey, Webster specifically asked not to have cabinet rank, feeling that the DCI should be an impartial disseminator of intelligence rather than a policymaker. Colby had a distant relationship with President Ford, exacerbated when he did not inform Ford of the existence of the family jewels before congressional committees and the press found out about them. To some extent, the business of the CIA goes on regardless of who is DCI. Like any bureaucracy, the agency has a life of its own, responding to events and pressures based on values instilled over time. But most of the DCIs have made their own marks on the agency, rearranging its various parts, establishing new offices, changing emphasis here or there, and in most cases imposing new regulations and controls. In that respect, William Webster, who took over as DCI in May 1987, was no different from his predecessors. What made his term distinctive was that he was the ultimate outsider, a lawyer who had been a federal judge prior to becoming FBI director. Webster had no political constituency, no political obligations, and no ties to the intelligence community. Because of that, what happened during Webster's 4-year term as Director of Central Intelligence provides an unusual opportunity to gain insight into the character of the modern CIA. Chapter 22, 0014. When a Director of Central Intelligence is to be nominated, each directorate hopes that one of its own will get the job. If a former analyst is nominated, the operations people grumble. If an operations officer gets the nod, he can never satisfy the expectations of the other directorates. As an outsider, William H. Webster, like most CIA directors, was from none of the directorates. Moreover, he had been FBI director for nearly 10 years. There is an instinctive rivalry between the Bureau and the CIA. Their jobs are similar and yet different, and bringing in someone from the FBI was like choosing the editor of the New York Times to head its natural competitor, the Washington Post. The idea that a former judge could direct the activities of an agency whose mission was to break the laws of other countries sent shivers up the spines of many in the Directorate of Operations. For all the harm William Casey had done to the CIA's reputation, Casey had still strongly supported the clandestine service. At the FBI, Webster had done a first-rate job of putting into place procedures that would prevent abuses such as COINTELPRO, a program approved by J. Edgar Hoover that included illegal mail openings and break-ins to gain information on the anti-war movement. Webster upgraded the Bureau's counterintelligence program from a neglected and shunned sideline to one of the most respected lines of work in the FBI. He approved such controversial sting operations as ABSCAM, which targeted members of Congress, and he emphasized pursuit of white-collar and organized crime. While the FBI under Webster overreached its authority in investigating the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, CISPES, the abuses never reached the point of illegality. The FBI investigated the group when it received allegations, which proved to be unfounded, that CISPES was involved in supporting terrorism. In the CISPES investigation, the abuses, which included inquiring into political beliefs, had not been approved by the director, as had been the case with abuses that took place under Hoover. While black and Hispanic agents filed complaints of discrimination under Webster's tenure, Webster's emphasis was always on hiring and promoting more minorities. Webster kept a card in his wallet with the latest minority statistics. From 1978 to 1987, while he was FBI director, the number of female special agents rose from 147 to 787. Black agents increased from 185 to 393. Hispanic agents rose from 173 to 400. Despite his impressive credentials in the law, Webster had no experience or special interest in foreign affairs. Born on March 6, 1924, in St. Louis, William Hedgecock Webster attended secondary school in Webster Groves, a suburb of St. Louis. He graduated from Amherst College in 1947 and from Washington University Law School in 1949. He served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy during World War II and in the Korean War, practiced law in St. Louis, and was appointed U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri in 1960. In 1961, Webster returned to the practice of law. In 1970, he was appointed a judge for the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri. In 1973, he was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Although Webster was a Republican, President Carter appointed him FBI Director in 1978. As the end of his 10-year term as FBI Director approached, Webster was already evaluating offers from major law firms when then-Vice President Bush asked him if he would like to be DCI. After Webster's first wife, Drusilla, died in 1984, Bush and his wife, Barbara, had invited Webster to stay with them at their home in Kennebunkport, Maine. Webster and Bush had spent the weekend playing tennis. While President Reagan never said so, it was plain that Webster had been chosen because of his reputation for imposing order on troubled agencies. Under William J. Casey, the CIA had become involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and had failed to adequately inform Congress of the mining of the harbors in Nicaragua. The CIA had begun to project an image of being out of control, the inevitable result of Casey's penchant for thumbing his nose at Congress. Webster was a first-class lawyer and judge whose integrity was beyond question, exactly what was needed to impose order on the CIA. For example, when the Carter White House asked the FBI to help guard the Shah of Iran when he came to the U.S. for treatment for cancer, Webster questioned whether the FBI had the legal authority to comply. That sent White House lawyers scurrying to the law books to find a legal justification. Only when they found a law permitting the FBI to assist other agencies in guarding foreign dignitaries did Webster accede to the White House request. To underscore the fact that he was an outsider who would not tolerate past abuses, Webster preferred that others refer to him as Judge. When he went to the FBI, it was in a state of disarray, said John P. Austin, a friend who nominated him to be chairman of the American Bar Association's Banking and Business Law Section. He decided that he didn't want to be known as the director. He wanted to be known as Judge Webster. The reason he did was he wanted to make it perfectly clear that his relationship to the FBI would be, in a sense, similar to his relationship as a judge to what came before him. If you went looking for the resume of the ideal DCI, it wouldn't be Bill Webster, one of his aides said. And yet in January of 1987, I'm not sure there was a better choice in the whole country to be DCI than Bill Webster. With President Reagan looking on, Webster became the 14th DCI on May 26, 1987. Then Supreme Court Justice Lewis F. Powell, Jr. swore him in. Pledging fidelity to the Constitution and the laws of our country, Webster observed, "Today I leave one proud institution in American life, the FBI, to join another one, the CIA." Noting that Webster had been an officer in the Navy, Reagan said that when the bosun's whistle was blown, Webster had responded. To commemorate the event, William Baker, Webster's public affairs director from the FBI, gave him a bosun's whistle from the British battleship HMS Hood engraved with the date he was sworn in. Webster declined to take a polygraph examination as part of the hiring process. But he did take what is known as a repolygraph almost immediately after taking office. The repolygraph is administered after employees are hired and is the same as the initial exam, except it does not include a number of questions on lifestyle. To Webster, it was a matter of principle. The president had nominated him, and the Senate had confirmed him. He would not subject himself to a test on whether he should be hired. But Webster recognized that the agency lives and dies on the polygraph. While universally hated, it is an integral part of every employee's existence. To demonstrate that he knew what it meant to take the test, he took a polygraph exam given to employees once they are already working for the agency. Casey had often popped into people's offices just to say hello. Webster was not that kind of guy. To be sure, he had a playful side. Besides playing tennis, he enjoyed the antics at the Alfalfa Club, which holds an annual stag dinner in Washington. A strictly no-women-no-press-allowed affair, it is one of the last gasps of the cigar-chomping, back-slapping, boozy days of yore, as the Washington Post called it. It's a night when the president, most of the cabinet, and congressional heavy hitters don't have to worry about public image. Webster also visited the Bohemian Club, an exclusive men's club 65 miles north of San Francisco that lists Ronald Reagan and George Bush as members. Webster liked American Indian art and other art of the American West. He liked country music, particularly the mother and daughter team known as the Judds, who became his friends. On his 54-acre family farm near Fulton, Missouri, he rode horses. He read history and Civil War books and spent a great deal of time researching the life of his great-grandfather, Colonel George P. Webster, a lawyer who led the Union's 25th Ohio Volunteer Infantry at the Civil War Battle of Perryville, Kentucky, on October 8, 1862. It was one of the bloodiest battles of the war, and Colonel Webster became one of the casualties when he fell from his horse, mortally wounded. One of Webster's favorite possessions was a 2-foot-high brown bear, Judge Webber, given to him by Mary Spaeth, a former White House fellow who had worked for him at the FBI. The bear wears black-rimmed glasses, pinstriped pants, an FBI T-shirt, tennis shoes, and judicial robes, a tennis racket clutched in its hands. Spaeth gave it to Webster after he gave her a locket when she left the FBI. "There were 30 guys at the FBI looking on," she recalled. "I thought, what if he doesn't think it's funny? I'm going to die. They'll shoot me right here." Webster opened the box and he started to laugh. He began to laugh so hard he began to cry. He took out his handkerchief and took off his glasses to wipe the tears from his eyes, and everybody else began to howl with laughter. After Webster's wife died, he led an active social life, dating a number of attractive women. He had a number of male friends, usually fellow lawyers or judges. While at the CIA, he jocularly signed letters to some of them 0014, doubling James Bond's code number because he was the 14th director of Central Intelligence. But Webster was not someone to go drinking with. In fact, as a Christian Scientist, he generally eschewed alcohol, although he occasionally had a glass of white wine at a party. Webster had never gone to a doctor. He never seemed to need one. His first wife, Drusilla, was also a Christian Scientist and died of breast cancer without receiving any medical attention. When CIA officials recommended a smoking ban in the building, Webster hesitated. He did not want to seem to be imposing his personal views on the agency. "Perhaps he should propose the rule and get comments," he told John B. Bellinger, his assistant. But he overcame his reservations and imposed the prohibition that had been recommended to him. The result was a collection of cigarette butts outside the building from smokers who took drags on the front steps. On the job, Webster was not someone who took off his jacket when others did. Rather, he inspired fear and respect. That was the way he wanted it, to be the judge who keeps his distance from the litigants, who reads all the pleadings and listens to all the arguments, but whose decision in the end is final. It was a style that was not calculated to win friends or loyalty. Rather, it won often grudging admiration. Like a judge, Webster relied on clerks, called special assistants, to filter material that came in and offer their opinions. While every DCI had special assistants, none relied on them so heavily or used such a systematic process for screening issues before decisions were made. Nor did other special assistants have the impressive credentials Webster's had. They were all lawyers and all came with resumes that looked as if they had been made up. Almost every one had graduated either magna cum laude or cum laude from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Columbia. They had clerked for Supreme Court justices or edited law reviews or had been Woodrow Wilson Foreign Affairs Fellows. Webster chose the special assistants the same way he chose tennis partners. "You can count on William to get the best player there is as his partner," said Walter M. Clark, a friend from childhood who practiced law with him in St. Louis. "It's done very subtly, but very precisely. He likes to win. He is awfully good at maneuvering things to end up with the best player as his partner." Like the clerks that served him when he was on the bench, Webster wanted his special assistants to read through the material he received, investigate and do research, and make recommendations. "The job was structured very much like what he had experienced on the bench," said Russell J. Broomer, one of his assistants who later became general counsel of the CIA. It was clear early on he was not setting up a classic chief of staff role or line responsibility, but rather a staff responsibility for information gathering, analyzing the way the decisions ought to be approached, and once made, assisting in getting decisions through the agency. In reviewing the assistant's recommendations, Webster wanted to know, how have we done in the past? Then he asked, why do we do it that way? You better have the answers to both, and you better have it right, Rumor said. If you are changing precedent, the question is, why are we changing it? Beyond that, the assistants were to eye proposals with the perspective of outsiders to see if the idea would make sense to the American people. For that reason, Webster, as a rule, wanted his assistants at the FBI and the CIA to stay with him only 2 years. That way, he said, they would not begin to reflect the views of the bureaucracy. I want you to ask every time something comes up, why is it being done this way? Webster told John B. Bellinger, who was his special assistant at the CIA until 1991. When you know why, it's time to go. There were two exceptions. Rumor, who was Webster's clerk at the Federal Appeals Court when Webster got the job at the FBI in 1978, and John B. Hotis, an FBI agent who had a law degree. Rumor became Webster's first special assistant at the FBI in 1978 and stayed with him until he left to join Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering in Washington in 1981. In 1987, Webster appointed Rumor special counsel to investigate the Iran-Contra affair at the CIA. A year later, he made him general counsel of the CIA. Unlike Rumor and the other assistants, Hotis did not come from the outside. He was more senior than the others and stayed throughout most of Webster's tenure at the FBI and CIA. Hotis acted as a sort of super clerk, with status slightly above the other special assistants. At the CIA, Webster gave him the title of counselor to the DCI. Generally, Hotis worked on special projects rather than the day-to-day issues that Webster's other assistants addressed. When he first came to the CIA, Webster brought with him William M. Baker, who had directed public and congressional affairs at the FBI. Baker became CIA Director of Public Affairs, but he also functioned as another personal assistant to Webster. Finally, Webster brought Peggy Devine, his executive secretary at the FBI. She was known as the Dragon Lady because of the way she fiercely guarded access to her boss. After weeks of briefings by each of the directorates, Webster took command. The first thing he encountered was outright hostility toward Congress, which was hardly surprising. "Don't brief. Limit disclosure," Casey once told a CIA associate, then uttered an expletive to describe all members of Congress, according to Veil by Bob Woodward. According to one of Webster's assistants at the time, CIA officials urged him not to be open with Congress. "Well, Judge, you don't want to say that. You can't say that," he was told. "Only say that if they ask that question." Often, holdovers from the Casey era compiled briefing books with sample questions and answers. The suggested answers gave a narrow response to the questions, avoiding possibly negative information. That never failed to infuriate Webster. Webster occasionally raised his voice with subordinates when he was mad, but to those who knew him, the most ominous sign was when his eyes became more steely blue than usual, and his lips became thinner so that his mouth seemed to disappear. It meant Webster was even more enraged than when he raised his voice. It happened a number of times, as he made it clear he would not tolerate anything except complete and honest disclosure. "He just couldn't stand the CIA's disdain for Congress," a former assistant said. "He thought it was ridiculous, dated, not in the best interests of the agency, not smart, and not good government. He really believed that Congress was the elected representative of the people. He couldn't stand the grumbling about sharing information with Congress." Webster never said anything negative about Casey, even in private. In fact, he had played golf with him and liked him personally more than Stansfield Turner, Casey's immediate predecessor. It was not Webster's style to express his true feelings even to his closest aides. Webster followed the same pattern at the FBI, where he never denigrated J. Edgar Hoover. Unlike Hoover, Webster had purposely avoided creating a cult of personality, stressing that the FBI was an institution whose mission must remain the same regardless of who was director. When some FBI executives complained about criticisms of the Bureau that came from Representative Don Edwards, a California Democrat who sits on the Judiciary Committee. Webster said, "I don't agree with him, but he is a congressman. He has oversight over us, and we are going to refer to him in a respectful tone." Webster led by example. It soon became clear that much of what Casey stood for would not be tolerated at the CIA. When subordinates at the CIA insisted that Webster should not tell Congress about a particular problem, Webster told them, "You're wrong. I do want to tell them that, and I am going to tell them that." Webster did not want anyone prosecuted for his testimony to Congress, as had happened to Richard Helms. When asked by Senator Stuart Symington on February 7, 1973, "Did you try in the Central Intelligence Agency to overthrow the government of Chile?" Helms answered, "No, sir." Helms also denied to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the agency had passed any money to opponents of Salvador Allende, a self-declared Marxist who had been elected president of Chile. In fact, at the direction of President Nixon, the CIA in September 1970 had tried to mount a military coup in Chile to prevent confirmation of Allende's victory in the Chilean presidential election. The agency had spent $8 million to prevent his confirmation. Helms agreed to plead nolo contendere to two misdemeanor counts of violating a federal statute, which made it an offense not to testify fully and completely before Congress. He told U.S. District Court Judge Barrington D. Parker on October 31, 1977, that he found himself in conflict between his oath to protect the CIA's secrets and the need to tell the truth to Congress. Parker fined him $2,000 and sentenced him to a jail term of 2 years, which was suspended. "I have thought about it many times, and I couldn't figure out another way. If I had it to do over, I don't think I would change it," Helms said recently. But Webster told the CIA there was another way. "You don't be disingenuous or dance around the questions," Webster would say. "You try to understand what they want to know and not confine yourself to what they actually ask you. But if they ask something you don't want to tell them or are not authorized to tell them because it would expose sources or methods, you should say, 'I am not authorized to say that.' Then go back to headquarters for further guidance." If underlings did not catch on quickly, they were out. One of the first casualties was Claire E. George, the deputy director for operations. Of all the jobs in the CIA, none is more sensitive than DDO. George had been Casey's liaison with the Hill when Casey was limiting disclosure to Congress about events in Nicaragua. Moreover, George's style was not compatible with Webster's. He had a cocky, secretive air about him, exactly the opposite of the responsible attitude Webster wanted to project. What was clear was he was not going to continue to be DDO for Webster, a Webster aide said. It first struck me then how important it was that the DDO's philosophy and style fit with the DCI. He, George, is a professional and his troops thought he walked on water, but their styles did not match. Webster told George he wanted him to resign. At the end of 1987, he did, convinced that Congress had made a deal with Webster that he would have to go if Webster was to be confirmed. In his place, Webster appointed Richard F. Stoltz. At 62, Stoltz was one of the most respected operations officers in the agency, a man who had served 31 years in the Directorate of Operations. During that time, Stoltz had been Moscow and London station chief and chief of the Soviet East European Division. In 1981, Stoltz retired after Casey appointed Max Hugel to head the directorate. Hugel was one of Casey's political cronies who knew nothing about intelligence. Casey had called Stoltz back from London and told him he wanted him to assist Hugel by running part of the directorate. Another assistant would run the rest. To Stoltz, the plan was a throwback to the days of OSS, when human collection was split between the area divisions and the rest of the clandestine service. Stoltz didn't think that division of responsibility had worked well in the OSS, and he was stunned that Casey would appoint someone to the most sensitive job in the agency who knew nothing about intelligence. Stoltz turned Casey down. Webster had known Stoltz briefly when they were both at Amherst, and the two had kept in touch since then. When Reagan asked Webster to become DCI, Webster consulted with Stoltz. Stoltz had pointed out the need to keep his distance from the president to avoid becoming a crony. Webster had said he would specifically decline to have cabinet status for that very reason. When Webster asked Stoltz to rejoin the agency as the top spy, no one had any question about his ability, and there were no resignations over his appointment. A short man with a graying pompadour, he had a low-key style that served him well. When Stoltz finally retired in 1990, Webster proudly pointed out during a ceremony in the director's conference room that he had brought Stoltz back to the CIA. "I did that. I did that," he said, motioning toward Stoltz. In contrast to dispatching Claire George, Webster wanted to keep Robert M. Gates as Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. After Casey's death from cancer on May 6, 1987, Gates had served as Acting Director of Central Intelligence. When questions arose about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair, Gates withdrew as President Reagan's nominee to be DCI, but continued as the Deputy DCI. Gates was unusually well qualified for the job. Born on September 25, 1943, in Wichita, Kansas, Gates graduated from the College of William and Mary and obtained a master's degree in history from Indiana University and a doctorate in Soviet studies from Georgetown University in 1974. His first experience with intelligence was as an Air Force intelligence officer with a Minuteman missile wing. Gates started as an analyst at the CIA in 1969 and moved to the National Security Council under President Nixon. After continuing at the NSC under President Ford, he returned to the agency, then moved back to the NSC under President Carter. In 1979, Gates again returned to the CIA, becoming Deputy Director for Intelligence in 1982. In that job, Gates developed the first system for holding analysts accountable for their record of forecasts and assessments. In 1983, Gates became chairman of the National Intelligence Council. In 1986, he became Deputy Director for Central Intelligence and, during that time, Acting Director. Brent Scowcroft, President Bush's National Security Advisor, brought him back to the White House in 1989 as his Deputy for National Security Affairs. Gates clashed with Secretary of State James A. Baker III over Baker's intention to give a speech in 1989 that was highly pessimistic about Mikhail S. Gorbachev's chances of delivering on his reform promises. Baker shelved the speech, but events proved him to be largely correct. Gates was a brilliant analyst who never failed to come out forcefully on an issue. As DDI, he had moved to sharpen the estimates, never bowing to Casey's pressure to exaggerate the prospects for the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, for example. Webster respected Gates's intellect and later pushed him as his successor. But Gates left the CIA in March 1989 to become Deputy Assistant to President Bush for National Security Affairs. In his place, Webster appointed Richard J. Kerr as Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. Like Gates, Kerr had spent most of his career on the analytical side of the House. Under Casey, he had become Deputy Director for Intelligence. While he was not the brilliant scholar that Gates was, Kerr had a practical, common-sense approach to problems, as well as a practical joker's mentality. When a topic in the Middle East was hot, Kerr showed up one morning at a meeting of Webster's executive committee wearing Arab dress. At Christmas, he wore a tie that played jingle bells. Around Halloween, he wore a gorilla outfit. In sharp contrast to Webster, Kerr practically never wore a jacket. Even in winter, he wore short-sleeve shirts. When Webster wore a jacket at lunch in the director's dining room, Kerr appeared in shirt sleeves. Some thought he was purposely trying to offset Webster's formality. Besides establishing centers for counterintelligence and counter-narcotics, one of Webster's more enduring changes was to systematize approvals for undertaking covert action. In the past, a committee called the Covert Action Review Group, CARG, had been used to examine and approve any covert action proposals. However, the committee functioned largely as a rubber stamp, informally signing off on proposals that were hand-carried from office to office. Webster did not want to emasculate covert action and could not do so if he had wanted to. Generally, the broad proposals originated with the National Security Council and the President. Since the CIA only implements policy, it needs to know what the policy is before it does anything. That includes the question of whether to undertake covert action and what form it should take. The White House and NSC gave the proposals to the CIA to fine-tune. But Webster did want to make sure every proposal was legal and made sense. just as if he were determining if one of his proposed judicial decisions complied with established law and precedent, Webster wanted to make sure that every covert action proposal had been tested against a set of unvarying questions. Does it fall within U.S. law? What would happen if it became public? Will the public understand it? Finally, will it work? Initially, Webster assigned two of his assistants, John Hodes and Nancy D. McGregor, to sit on the CARG committee as his representatives. Like Hodes, McGregor had moved over to the CIA from the FBI with Webster. After they left the agency, other aides sat on the committee, which met every 2 weeks in the office of the Director of Congressional Affairs on the 7th floor of the original headquarters building. To some of Webster's aides, it seemed the committee consisted of old boys getting together. Once it got up to the CARG, they no longer questioned the program. They questioned, "How do we do this tiny part?" McGregor said. "In general, we tried to have a little more analysis done. We thought by the time it got to the CARG, it was a little too pat, with not enough discussion and critical thinking about the underlying purposes. The big questions were not asked. We wanted them asked. Webster wanted us to make sure they were asked. They were annoyed about that." As a result of the questioning by Webster's assistants, some proposals were modified, either to limit their scope or to eliminate dubious aspects. Once they were approved by CARG, they went back for approval by the White House. Then they were presented to the Congressional Oversight Committees. Webster wanted the covert action proposals to be reviewed to make sure they would make sense to the American people if they were to be revealed, McGregor said. "It sounds simplistic, but if you think about it, this approach places good controls over the proposals. The people in the agency can't be the sole watchdogs because of the natural tendency to get too close to the programs and lose perspective." Webster's questions were, would people understand why and how a particular program was being carried out, or would they say this is crazy, ludicrous? How could our government be doing something like that? "I think the changes he made in covert action proposals were not to say, we aren't going to do it, but we are going to approach this according to different procedures. Or he would send things back for more work when he wasn't satisfied with how they looked or felt," Rumor said. Webster's assistants prepared a briefing book listing all the covert action programs with an analysis of their purposes. Enclosed in a black three-ring binder, the material summarized each program, roughly 12 at any given time, with two or three pages of description. The idea was to give Webster a handy reference guide that he could keep in his office and refer to when questions arose, as they invariably did. The idea provoked outrage within the Directorate of Operations, which thought the existence of the book would somehow create a greater possibility of leaks. But once the book had been put together and placed on Webster's desk, it seemed everyone wanted his own copy to validate his status. Only the deputy directors, the general counsel, and the inspector general received one. Particularly after the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, Webster decided that the Directorate of Operations, battered by both the Church Committee hearings and the Iran-Contra affair, had become so cautious that it passed up chances it should have taken to recruit agents. The best example was in Iraq, where the CIA had practically no agents of value reporting on Saddam Hussein. There is no scientific way to evaluate how well an intelligence agency is doing in recruiting agents. In the case of Saddam Hussein, the CIA was hampered by the fact that Saddam Hussein allowed only family members, or those who had been loyal to the Iraqi leader since childhood, into his inner circle. Webster did not want CIA officers to take needless risks in penetrating such a country. But Webster believed there was a middle ground, one that would allow the agency's spies to be more aggressive while not becoming cowboys. In talks with Directorate of Operations officials, he noted that he had never disapproved a covert action proposal or a major intelligence operation. "I want people in the DO who are risk-takers, not risk-seekers," Webster said at Richard Stoltz's retirement party at the end of 1990. Particularly after Kuwait, Webster, like directors before him, pushed for more foreign language training. To upgrade training generally, he tried to promote officers who did a stint as CIA teachers. And he emphasized more reporting on economic issues. Webster wanted more accountability in the agency and more clarity in its reports. He hated acronyms and he hated the word feel. People could believe or state or conclude, but they could never feel, We are not paid to feel, Webster wrote in a memo to CIA employees. We are paid to think. Webster could not stand it when CIA officials submitted papers to him without attributing where they had gotten the information. In answer to some questions, he was handed background papers that did not say who had written them or who had submitted them. He demanded that each paper he received carry the name of the author's office, and his or her telephone extension. Webster was used to having personable FBI agents as his security guards. At the CIA, the guards were from the Office of Security, and they were anything but personable. Indeed, the young men assigned to guard Webster seemed to think they were the Gestapo. Ramrod stiff, they bristled if anyone asked them their names. At receptions attended by Webster, they clung to the walls, looking like rent-a-cops in a grade B movie. One weekend, William Baker's wife, Robin, decided to surprise Baker when her husband and Webster were due in New Jersey to attend a party given by Malcolm Forbes. Originally from New Jersey, Robin Baker drove from her parents' home to the airport, her Labrador retriever on a leash. There, she saw Webster's security detail with squiggly wires sprouting from their ears. The plane had not yet arrived. When she approached her husband and Webster, she did not want to alarm the guards, so she introduced herself. "Hello, I'm Mrs. Baker. I'm married to Bill Baker, who is flying in with the director," she said as the dog wagged his tail. "I just wanted you to know I'm here to greet my husband, so you know who I am." The guard did not respond. "I guess I'll go and find somebody else to talk to," she said. The man ignored her. Several minutes later, two guards came over to her and brusquely asked her for identification. Then they demanded proof that she was married to Baker. Having just gotten married, she had trouble finding a credit card in her handbag with her husband's name on it. The guards acted as if they had just caught her breaking into a bank, and she was livid. Baker never told Webster of the incident, but Webster himself had become unhappy with the guard's style. With Webster's approval, Baker met with the head of the security detail. "We need to go to charm school together," Baker said. He then met with all the guards. "Look, this is what the director expects," he said. "In addition to the professionalism which you have, he expects a little more than that." Baker said he did not want them to be so tight. He gave them a supply of his business cards. "If you're at a function or party with him, and someone asks if you're CIA and you can't quite tell them that, hand them my card," Baker said. "Say, if you have any questions, call this gentleman." Webster found one of the CIA's biggest problems was the fact that each directorate is a separate fiefdom, with the Directorate of Operations usually the most dominant. The DO tended to be suspicious of the Directorate of Intelligence, which in turn resented not being fully trusted. There were constant complaints from both sides. Meanwhile, the CIA's other two directorates resented being looked down upon. Webster wanted more cross-pollination, and he began to rotate people so that they worked for two or three of the directorates during their careers. "At the CIA, they are kings of their own dominion," a former Webster assistant said. "It is set up so loyalties are within directorate. You can make your career within that division. You make or break your career based on loyalty to a specific boss, not the head of an agency or the head of a different division." Turner had encountered the same problem. "I think the biggest problem is coordination among the various branches," he said. The attitude was entirely different from that of the FBI, where the FBI director and the special agent in charge of each field office were the unquestioned bosses. Like the FBI, the CIA was a semi-military organization that obeyed orders. But the boss at the CIA was the head of one's own division, not the head of the agency. The result was that the directorates were not eager to share information with each other. While some secrecy was necessary, Webster and his assistants found it was often used to enhance people's own importance, hampering everyone's work. Despite the fact that they had clearances for virtually every program, the assistants were sometimes prevented from knowing what they felt they needed to know. "Very few people at the CIA know the complete picture because very few are allowed to know it," McGregor said. "That is what makes it so difficult to get at the whole truth. This is exacerbated by the fact that so very few feel any loyalty to the head of the agency. Rather, their loyalties are to the heads of their divisions or their directorates." These attitudes contributed to the agency's involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. Agency people from the director on down actively shunned information, Robert Gates, then the deputy director for Central Intelligence, later told the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. We didn't want to know how the Contras were being funded. We actively discouraged people from telling us things. Webster decided that the CIA's Inspector General was not tough enough to do the job of policing the agency, a fact underscored by what happened during the Iran-Contra affair. Historically, the office was the domain of amiable CIA officers who were at the end of their careers and did not want to rock the boat. If a CIA director did not like the Inspector General's criticisms, he could remove him. Back in 1960, after a review of the Office of Security, the Inspector General recommended that the CIA prepare a cover story if the agency's mail opening program were ever uncovered. The report made no mention of the fact the program was illegal. According to Tom Gilligan, a former CIA operations officers seldom suffered permanent career damage for poor performance or incompetence, even when agents were killed or compromised. Yet when Gilligan appealed a decision not to give his station more officers, he found his performance was downrated because of it. He felt he could not bring the problem to the attention of the CIA's Inspector General because of the Inspector General's lack of independence. What is needed, Gilligan said, is inspectors general who come from outside the organization. Before Congress created an Office of Inspector General, Webster elevated the importance of the job. He appointed William F. Donnelly, a tough, respected officer who acted as one of Webster's advisors, to the position. At the same time, Webster did not favor the approach proposed by Congress. In response to the Iran-Contra affair, the oversight committees decided that the Inspector General should be appointed by the President with confirmation by the Senate. Then only the President could fire him. Congress also wanted access to the Inspector General's reports, which generally went only to the director and the affected departments within the CIA. Even though 19 other federal agencies had independent watchdogs approved by Congress, Webster saw the proposal as a reflection on his own performance. He was the director of Central Intelligence, and he was charged with making sure the CIA conformed to the laws. It was a question of accountability. If he failed, he should be replaced. But he insisted the Inspector General should answer to him, not to Congress or to the President. What most troubled Representative Dave McCurdy, an Oklahoma Democrat who led the fight for the bill, was Congress's lack of access to reports prepared by the Inspector General. I wanted to find out how effective they were, how much support they had, said McCurdy, who later became chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. The more I got into it, the more I was concerned. There was no way for us to find out. Let me see some of your reports. You can't have them. Can I have an index so I can pick a couple? No. I think Webster totally mishandled the whole situation, McCurdy said. I said I believe we have a right to see the reports, not as to individuals, but on general policy considerations and how the Soviet division is doing. He said you are not entitled to it, kind of exerting executive privilege. The reason was more micromanagement. He didn't want us to invade his executive turf. Webster lost the battle, and Congress passed a law establishing an independent inspector general at the CIA. Frederick P. Hitz, a lawyer and former CIA officer who was Webster's choice, got the job and took office in November 1990. Besides investigating allegations of wrongdoing or mismanagement, Hitz continued the practice of examining each office and station every 5 years to determine if they are doing their job. That entails reading reports and cable traffic to see how agents are being handled, whether good judgment is being exercised in recruiting agents, and whether resources are being used wisely. The complaints examined by the office ranged from allegations of defalcations to matters of taste. Just before Hitz took over as Inspector General, the office had received a complaint by some female employees that the unisex barbershop in the old building provided copies of Playboy and Penthouse for customers to read while waiting. Without issuing a formal ruling, the office quietly resolved the matter by telling the barbers to drop the offending magazines. If Webster lost the battle over an independent inspector general, he won on most issues requiring congressional approval. While his credibility and cooperative approach contributed to that record, it was also a result of good staff work. In that arena, Webster had a secret weapon. his special assistants.